guitarist Jason Veal. Welcome to Crossover, Jason.
Thank you. Thank you very much,
Joe. We interrupted your practicing, I guess. Well, yeah, you've actually made an album with that on it, isn't it?
Yes. The previous CD is an all Albanese record, all music of Isaac Albanis, the pianist who lived from 1860 to 1909. The title of it is Sevilla, after one of the pieces that's on the CD.
Now, is this the Leyenda?
This is Leyenda,
it's
or
very famous.
Or Asturias.
Asturias,
yeah.
Yes.
It's known as with both of those titles.
Yes.
Probably one of the most famous pieces on the guitar, and ironically, it's not originally written for the guitar.
Well, I was just surprised now for you to say that Albanis was a pianist. I wasn't really quite aware of that, I guess, because he's written an enormous amount of guitar music, of course, orchestral music, but...
Actually, he didn't write any guitar music.
No?
No. Everything that you hear by Albanis that you hear on a guitar is a transcription from a piano score.
How interesting.
Yes.
Who started that?
The earliest the guitarist that I can recall in history that would have done this sort of thing regularly were Miguel Llobet and Francisco Tárrega, who lived, you know, near the,
yes,
were really doing much of their work near the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. And Segovia, Andres Segovia, was just a young man in his late teens, early 20s, around this time. And so then he, of course, carried the torch from them, and he made his arrangements as well of music of Albanis, and then, of course, went on
the great,
to...
The Bach things.
And Bach.
He did,
and,
yeah.
And
I was reading some things about you, and I think I read somewhere that you said you didn't really discover Segovia or appreciate Segovia until you were a little bit older.
A little bit older, yes.
That's interesting.
Well, I think when you're young and you're working, you know, working on just your general playing, you know, mm-hmm, and trying to eliminate mistakes and this sort of thing. I mean, the people that really stand out in my generation are players like, say, John Williams or Manuel Barueco.
Yes.
So there's a certain, and also the recordings that I had, this is really, you know, not any fault of Segovia's, but once the recording technology really became widely available for
right.
him, he was much older. And so we really didn't get to hear, for the most part, on recordings, really, Segovia at his peak.
I remember seeing him, actually. He did a concert at Carnegie Hall, I believe.
Oh, yes.
That was many, many years ago, and he was already quite old.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, he was an icon. But,
right.
But I wondered, of course, in the scheme of things, I remember Julian Bream was considered also an outstanding.
Yes, and I had a lot of records of his, and I really loved
it.
I mean, I really liked listening. I think, you know, just the character of their playing, Bream and Segovia in particular, I think really hit me more when I was in my late teens, you know, early 20s.
More
but
profound,
when
you think?
Or? Yeah, there's something, well, maybe not necessarily more profound, but just there's more it's more imaginative, the interpretation. They use a lot more color and I feel really like I'm more influenced by that kind of playing. Actually.
So does the guitarist decide how to produce the sound, perhaps on a string, or is it indicated on the music, or do you say, well?
Yeah, it's indicated on the music, and in newer compositions and more and maybe you know, a lot of 20th century compositions, they will say dolce, which means sweet,
mm-hmm,
and that. Is a clear indication to the guitarist that they should be playing in the middle of the string, which is a warmer, sweeter sound, as opposed to P-O-N-T, which you'll see Ponticello, which is near the bridge.
Oh, shit.
It produces, of course, a totally different sound.
Yeah,
I feel like it just seemed that Bream, for example, when he accessed these colors, there's just something they just seemed a little bit more,
the artist,
just more real.
Yeah,
there's something
something
really powerful about it.
I know,
and
John,
it informed his interpretation. You know, it really was powerful.
Would you say it's the Spanish school of guitar playing that has really governed classical guitar?
I'd say for the most part, I mean, we're essentially descendants of Spanish guitar playing. Although now as it's moved into the conservatories and, in not just America, but around the world, mm-hmm. It's studied, of course. So it really is truly a more international instrument and truly a more accepted as a concert instrument alongside of the piano or violin.
But still as a solo instrument,
either a
concerto or a solo recital.
Exactly.
But never in the orchestra, really pretty much as...
Right, as a soloist,
yes.
With concerto or... Mm-hmm. And there's chamber music, too. I do a great deal of chamber music, yes.
Was it Paganini? Was it his sister who played the guitar? Or did he play the... He also
played
the guitar.
Yes, he was a really good guitarist.
He was a guitarist,
yes.
Was really quite
in fact, there was a feature of his concerts was to bring out a guitarist, and then they would play, one of Paganini's violin and guitar sonatas, and then they'd switch instruments.
He was such
talk about
showman.
A show.
Yeah, really putting
that must have been pretty incredible.
But I guess the guitar. I mean, the history is so very, very. It's an ancient instrument, really, but what you're playing is the six-string guitar, which is
essentially descended from Spanish mm-hmm. building. Of the late 19th and early 20th century, of the Torres model, the kind of guitar that Tárrega would have played.
And, okay.
So it hasn't changed that much. I mean, there's certain aspects of the design, like the bracing underneath the guitar, that luthiers are still experimenting with because we are still in a stage where they would like to, where guitarists would like to try to make the instrument louder, if at all possible.
Yeah, well, that's hard.
Yes.
That's hard unless you electrify it, of course. Right. And is it like the lute in any way?
It's a distant cousin,
very
sure.
distant,
in the fact that there's the lute along the neck or the fretboard, mm-hmm. you would have designated markers or frets, which would have been tied with gut in long ago.
Okay.
And then the guitar, of course, we have metal frets that designate the pitches, and then
what's the spacing of them? Those are the raised.
These raised metal
long stem
strips
for our audience. Yes,
yes.
Strips where you can indicate where, whereas on a violin you don't have frets.
That's right.
Or a cello or any of these.
And then our right hand is what produces, unlike a string instrument like the violin, which is the sound is produced with a bow. Our right hand carefully. Shaped and polished fingernails.
I see one that's extremely long.
Well, yeah, this is idiosyncrasy, I suppose, of mine. I use a ping pong ball for my thumbnail, which is common in the guitar world to the classical guitar community to use one as a replacement if your nail breaks. But I use one pretty much all the time on my thumbnail.
What do you mean? You make a nail out of it?
Yes, you cut a ping pong ball in half, and then you get some cuticle scissors and carve like a little crescent moon out of it or a half moon, and then you fashion it so that it fits underneath a remaining section of your real fingernail, and then
and
you
glue
affix
it
with crazy glue.
So you don't go into Sally's Beauty and buy some.
No, that's I mean, some guitarists use that as an option as well to just acrylic their nails.
Really? But, that's really amazing. I mean, I never thought of that. Of course, one doesn't think of that, but I do remember that you would always see the guitarist with a long fingernail, the
yes.
thumb certainly. It's a pick, actually.
Right. Well, we use four of the five fingers of our right hand as essentially plectrums,
all styles of music?
No, I mean, this is really particular to the classical guitar.
Even in the Bach?
But yes, anything really that we're playing. That's really the standard practice is to, and in fact, I think our technology, if you will, of taking care of the nail files, we use, typically we can use automotive sandpaper to get them to a very glass-like surface so that there's no, hopefully there's there's no nicks or bumps or anything in the nail surface.
Now, how do you survive in real life with that right hand?
You're just very careful. You just learn to protect them. You learn to protect your right hand. You open doors with your left hand.
And, really? Yeah. Interesting.
You try to do more things with your left hand.
But of course, I mean, musicians are very careful with their hands, but that's specifically very, very different.
Yes.
Because one hand is very different from the other.
Yes.
So you have different. This unique quality.
Yes.
So now, Jason, you are a classical guitarist. You have rather a very interesting background. Your parents were not musicians at all, were they?
No, certainly not professionally. I mean, my dad played trumpet years ago in a drum corps, but no, not trained musicians. And my mother bought me a guitar when I was five.
Why?
Because I wouldn't stop listening to their record collection.
Of guitar music?
No, we had no guitar music. I mean, well, there was a Carlos Montoya,
uh-huh,
a flamenco record in there, but I was listening to my mom's soul records, you know, from the 60s,
my
R&B
goodness.
Stuff like Motown and mm-hmm. the Stax singles and stuff like that, and the Beatles, and she had quite a few Beatles albums, which I fell in love with immediately from the time I was about three.
How could you define their style in terms of playing the guitar? I mean, they were electric guitars.
Sure, and I mean, and that was, you know, a typical, their sound, especially when they came through, was really, you know, the guitar just functioned as it would have functioned in a normal rock and roll band at the time. You know, you just kind of wailing away on
mm-hmm.
Some chords underneath,
right.
And the singing, of course, would have been the feature in the beat, you know, the drum beat.
Did you ever do any of that?
I never actually put together any kind of band when I was growing up in elementary school or high school. I loved the music. I mean, it always sort of kept an ear attuned to what was happening in popular music. But I would often just play stuff off of the radio, and I think
by
I
ear,
just by ear.
And you
it
wanted
off the
guitar. This.
Well, you know, I just sort of ended up with it, I think.
Kinda
my mom
cool,
bought
huh?
it for me, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I was five. And we didn't even take lessons. I just played things, just messed around on it. I think my mother knew she didn't want me to just go to the local music store, you know, and just learn, you know, Led Zeppelin riffs.
Right.
Because I think she could tell that I was, just from when I was real small, that I was singing harmony lines and stuff like that along with her records and my dad's jazz records. So I think she figured I would, she figured, well, he can just pull that stuff off by ear if he wanted to. I don't need to take him to a store to, you know, have someone teach him that. She knew that there was something more refined. You know, I think she had an idea of what Spanish guitar was. But I don't think we really knew what classical guitar was until the Buffalo Guitar Quartet came to my school.
I grew up in Buffalo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My mom was working at my school as a secretary for the librarian, and they came. The Buffalo Guitar Quartet did a lunchtime concert, and I want him to study something like that.
Well, you know, that says a lot for having music in the schools, because here you
yep.
were, a student that was talented. You didn't quite know you were talented. And then these wonderful artists came to the school and you said...
Right.
And
my
mother
said... Yeah, she said, ah, okay, now like I can point him in that direction.
Uh-huh.
That gave us direction, basically. So,
you began to study?
Immediately, yeah, that summer. She just randomly, I think, she asked all four members if they would, you know, come, if one of them would come to the house and teach privately.
Oh,
you know?
That's amazing.
So, yeah,
well,
Jeremy Sparks was my first teacher there.
And now you also were a Naumburg winner, aren't you?
Not a winner. I was a prize winner in the competition. I took second.
Second prize. In the Naumburg, do they have categories of instruments, or is it just general?
Each year, the Naumburg is a competition that features a different instrument each year.
I see.
So, you know, that one year in 96, they featured, it was going to be a classical guitar competition.
When did you decide that this is what you really wanted to do? I mean, you had to practice all these years, and of course, you, being a guitarist, I guess, always had opportunities to do something that wasn't anything like this. When did you really decide, I want to study and I want to make a career with this?
I think the moment definitely was sometime during or just after my first recital, my first
How old were you?
I was 12, and I had given, by that point, I was playing concert repertoire, and I had given a full-length recital with intermission, and we, you know, we printed up like these fake tickets and stuff like that.
Oh, that's great.
So, you know, and had our family members, and I mean, we put it in the paper, so some people from, you know, or the area came to it. But so we did it, you know, we did it like a professional recital, rented the church, and it was at that point that I felt good. I mean, it felt really nice to play for music for people.
You weren't scared or anything?
No. I was a little nervous right before I went on stage, but then while I was playing, I just sort of got into the music. And
did you have a stool and everything for your foot?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a big thing.
Oh, yes.
The little foot stool. Where did you actually study, though? Did you, and finally, when you got older?
Well, after high school, I left Buffalo and went to the Cleveland Institute of Music, where I studied with John Holmquist and got my bachelor's degree there. And I ended up winning an important competition a little ahead of schedule during my junior year at the Cleveland Institute of Music. It was the Guitar Foundation of America International. And that basically started, you know, was the beginning of a professional career, because the first prize, you do an extensive tour.
Were your teachers urging you on to make a concert career?
My teacher was more of the attitude that if you could do, certainly do that if I wanted to. And the thing is, he could already tell anyway how focused I was about it. It was just something that he knew I wanted to do, so we didn't even really have to discuss it much. But he was more, it was more important to him that that individual student was happy in doing what they were doing. So since, you know, I was already
very
performing,
happy.
You know, during while I was going to school, I mean, he just, we never really had to discuss it. It was just a matter of, he wanted to make sure I had really gotten my training, and as far as, especially technique and tone and sound and that kind of thing, a little bit, you know, more under control than it was before I got there.
Now, you also had quite a lovely appointment by the United States Information Agency. You were kind of an ambassador.
Yes, that was amazing.
When was that?
That was in 95. And
How old were you then?
As a competition, I was 21.
Very young.
Yeah, that was great. And I got to travel like seven countries in Southeast Asia. It was amazing.
What an experience. How were you received?
Very well. It was amazing. And the best part of it was playing for the public. I mean, about half of the concerts during the 6-week tour, about half of them were for, you know, embassies or, you know, officials and stuff like that. But the ones I relished really were playing for just to see what I just wanted to really see what the reaction to the music I was bringing them.
What were you playing?
Well, I was, you know, since it was an exchange program, we were encouraged to program American music. So I played music by David Leisner, Ian Krause, and you know, several other things, and I probably put about half of the program is like newer American pieces, and then the other half some more Latin American or Spanish type things, like, you know, Barrios, Albanese,
yes,
Jorge Morel, things like that. And I, you know, oh, but also I would even program things like Hans Werner Henze, you know, some guitar music.
Yeah.
And that was interesting, because sometimes in certain places that would be equally well received as, say, something by Morel, which I thought was really interesting.
We played something on the station the other day of Leo Brower.
Oh, yes.
Who is a brilliant guitarist, isn't he?
Oh, he's a great
and
guitarist.
Conductor, and a wonderful, the music, I mean, it's very contemporary.
It's
but
beautiful.
But wonderful. And I don't think people really are too aware of his existence.
Not enough. I mean, it's a lot of that, I think, has to do with the fact that he's Cuban and he's, you know, there's some problems, I think, you know, getting over here and having his music played in the United States. Although he has done some film scoring for some fairly well-known films like Water for Chocolate, and I think there's another one.
Yes, he did that, right.
So, but yeah, I mean, he's somebody I feel it should be more
He's amazing.
More
and also another my love is Piazzolla.
I mean, there's.
Do you do anything? Do you play anything?
I play the piece I play a lot is the one for flute and guitar, the L'Histoire du Tango. And I also play it. I'll play that with Gary Schocker a lot. I've recorded it on a Zika with Martha Ahrens, Cleveland Orchestra flutist. And so but I also play it in a duo with violinist Suvin Kim. And so yes. It's very versatile. Like I like the sound of it on violin.
On violin
equally.
I would think because the tango music, of course, it leans toward that because the tango ensemble is very much string oriented.
Yes.
But I think some of those contemporary. I mean, it's contemporary, and of course he was such an important composer. I think one of my favorites.
He's just red hot in the classical music world right now.
Classical and also, of course, the tango. I mean, he's just amazing.
Yeah.
You've got a fan here.
Now,
you won the first prize from the Guitar Foundation of America. That was an international competition. When was that?
That was 92. That was one
was
I won
you.
While I was still in school.
So having said all this, you came out with a new album, The Music of Pat Metheny. Now, why?
It's my eighth CD. And,
but why did you
choose? But why this, right? Why the departure? I get asked that a lot. It's so different from the other ones, but it really, for me, is not really a departure for me because when I was in college, I was also on the side learning how to, improvise and play chord charts and this sort of thing and like I said I had the sound of modern jazz in my ear from the time I was three because of my dad's record collection. He didn't have much use for pop music, mm-hmm. He was mainly a jazz guy.
He loved jazz.
So when I got into college I really began to explore that. I mean, to the point where eventually I had like over 300 CDs of like all the different periods of jazz history, represented.
But jazz guitar is so very different from what you do.
Very, very different. But it wasn't about for me, as with any music, it's never about the instrument. I mean, it was more about just the composition of it and the sound of it and the feeling that one gets from it. I just feel like if I listen to one style of music, whether it be only classical or only jazz or only pop, I would feel unfulfilled.
Did you ever want to replicate that? I mean, in terms of playing jazz.
Well, that's what I was starting to do in college, and I would play in a jazz context in ensembles around Cleveland, just with a jazz guitar and, chop the chords and then mm-hmm. take a solo and this sort of thing.
It's the same instrument though?
No,
it's not.
I had a big, electric guitar.
I see.
Jazz box, which I still have. I borrowed it from somebody and then I eventually bought it, gave him
$200. With a funny shaped guitar? Was it one of those?
No,
weird
it looked
things?
Like it was actually a very old one. It doesn't even have a cutaway out of it. So the body is, it's full. An old one. Mm-hmm. So and it's just it was just real beat up, but it was all I had. And I wasn't really doing it very seriously. I was just doing it for fun. And again, just basically by ear and picking up things from recordings and sort of formed a style of improvising and playing. And I even got called after a while, like, oh, can you fill in for so-and-so
right.
at a gig? So I actually began to develop this a little bit of
a reputation.
As a jazz guitarist. I mean, I'm talking very, very small.
Minimal.
Reputation.
Yeah.
I was just beginning. By that time, of course, my career had already started, like, really taking off with classical guitar, which is what, of course, I was really doing. But
so what you've done in this, and you'll play something from the album for us, but you've also done a suite there with a Bach dance suite,
right.
Using the not a passacaglia, but I think you've used the gigue and
gavotte
and
an allemande.
The prelude.
Just getting back to the Metheny CD, I used to do with the classical guitar. I used to do solo arrangements of anything that I was just kind of into. If it was a Stevie Wonder song or the Beatles or whatever, Wayne Shorter. Mm-hmm. And Pat Metheny's stuff translated really well to making like a little classical guitar piece out of it. So I ended up doing probably enough to fill two CDs worth, you know, over time, over a course of about 5 or 6 years. But then, you know, yeah, we decided, you know, the record label, Azika and I decided that we maybe put a record together, sort of, I suppose it's kind of a tribute, you know, to a tribute record in a way, but, you know, to Pat's music. But it's very
contemplative. It's very, very...
Right, and those are the things that seem to work best. And so the Baroque Suite idea just happened to me late at night when I was about to fall asleep, and I started hearing this tune of his, James, which is like a sort of like a light bossa nova thing, and I started hearing it as a gavotte. Here, I'll tune up and, you know.
Okay.
So first, the original goes, so I'm going to approximate what the original sounds like. So then I started hearing that as kind of like a gavotte sort of rhythm. And then I could hear it as a jig as well. And so at that point, I got out of bed because I thought, wow, if I could...
Do the whole suite.
If I can take four other songs and make, you know, different dances out of them, it would make a better record, I thought. It's very important to me, like with the Sevilla, the way we put the pieces together in the program order, it's very important to me that a listener can take it and listen to it all the way through and enjoy it all the way through. So we felt this would switch up the flow a little bit, just change the direction of it a little, add some faster tempos.
Yes, because one can fall into this lull of you really realize that music all comes from the same place.
Right.
I mean, and like you just illustrated, it's the meter that changes or whatever, but it's, you take a melody and then you kind of reinvent it.
Yes,
within a certain period.
Right.
You know, stylistically. And it becomes something else, really, which is what you did on this album.
And that was what was fun about making the record and fun about doing the transcription.
Oh, really beautiful. Yeah. The whole album actually has that feel, though. It's very, as I said, it makes you think, it makes you relax, and it makes you feel things rather intensely. Very beautiful.
That's wonderful. Thank you. I mean, if that can convey the same kind of feeling I get from a lot of Matheny's music, then that would be great.
You did it. Now, as far as transcription, which is what you're really doing in many cases, it's really you're really rewriting it.
Yes, there's a bit of composition involved.
Did you study harmony? Did you study that?
Absolutely.
Was that something that you did? You hear that when you were young, or was this something?
I could hear it, but it's a matter, you know,
learning,
you can
what
hear
you
it,
heard.
It's a matter of identifying or placing names to it, like, you know, C minor minor 7, F dominant 7. That's something that my training at the Cleveland Institute of Music, which has a stellar theory department.
Oh, it's Cleveland altogether. marvelous musically. I think they are the most... probably one of the most underrated cities in terms of the orchestra as well.
And the orchestra is amazing.
And of course, the quartet used to be phenomenal.
And they were one of the best.
One of the greatest in the world.
Yep. And so that school is one of the greatest.
Yes. Wonderful school.
That theory department then just strengthened my ear training, my knowledge of theory about how chords function within within a piece of music, and also we learned about form and structure. how, like, you know, the structure of a sonata form movement or a symphony and this sort of thing. Those give you these tools that then that just help your ear now to identify more clearly what it's hearing. So that became then very easy then from that point to pull things just off of records by ear, which is what I did with all the Matheny.
But as a guitarist, you really tend to think chordally. I mean, I think that's one thing. And once that's defined,
yes,
you know, I mean, you know where you're going. You can make a melody that is
that's
a chord.
Right.
But,
that's right.
But again, a lot of instruments don't think that way.
Right, right. So but I think pianists and guitarists in
to
particular.
To some degree, yeah. Absolutely, because you're really thinking of it as a chordal structure.
Yes.
Now, so this is your newest album. It's been
yes.
very successful,
it's
hasn't
been doing
it?
Pretty well, yeah, I think so. I mean, for a classical record, at least.
Well, it's. I'm not even going to use the word crossover because it isn't. It's but this is embodies all of the elements of classical music, and I guess it's. Well, it's not folk at all. I mean, you don't feel that.
Yeah, I've been asked a lot. I mean,
you really don't feel that.
I was asked by a couple interviewers about it. Like, well, what is this? I mean, is it a jazz CD? Is it a classical CD? And it's really hard. And it's, you know, it's clearly when you listen to it, there's no attempt to cross over either. It's just
what it is.
It just is what it is. It's really hard to classify, and I kind of like that about it. It's just its own sort of strange thing.
Well, you've defined what music is because, of course, the elements are there on both sides of the fence. Really, really. So I think you got a winner here.
Oh, well, thank you.
We're
proud of it.
So this can be gotten. What is the label again?
The label is Azica, A-Z-I-C-A.
And
you can get this CD and my other ones as well at azica.com, but they're also available at amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and Borders, Tower.
The
major outlets.
When was this released, Jensen?
This was released in late October, I believe, of 2005.
That's doing really, really well.
Thanks.
That's great. Well, I am so thrilled that you had the time to come here. You're on your way to a guitar festival in Mexico?
Yes. Well, I'm going to be staying here in Philadelphia tonight at just like to acknowledge Astral Artistic Services,
an
organization I was
organization.
With for quite a while.
Were you? I wasn't aware of that.
Yes, for about 8 years I was with them, and the president Vera Wilson always invites me to stay, and it's always great to see her. So I'll stay here tonight in Philadelphia, and then head home for a few days and to do some teaching at the Cleveland Institute of Music.
I had the
guitar department there now.
I see.
And then I had to Mexico for the Culiacan International Guitar Festival for about 4 or 5 days, and then I immediately get back to Cleveland. We have our guitar weekend, the Guitars International Cleveland Institute of Music Guitar Weekend, where we will have guitarists Rafaela Smits and Jorge Cardoso in a recital with soprano Liliana Rodriguez. We will have Manuel Barueco play on Saturday night, and then I will play on Sunday afternoon. Yes, I have to follow Manuel.
Oh, I was going to say, you're in good company. I think I'm going to get a ticket to Cleveland. But so, again, will it be a lot of Spanish repertoire?
Sure, yeah. Sure. Well, my recital will be, the first half will be Spanish music from a large period of time. I'll be playing some Mudara from the 16th century, and the Fernando Sor, and
yes,
Julian Arcas, who is in between Sor and Tarraga. Mm-hmm. And I'll play some Tarraga and Albéniz. So that'll be the first half, and then the second half I'll play this Matheny Baroque suite.
Just terrific. Again, thank you for coming, Jason, bringing your beautiful instrument and your beautiful playing here to our studios at WRTI.
Thank you, Jill. It's been a pleasure.
Hope we can do it again.
Thanks.
Our guest today has been guitarist Jason Vio.